The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Pat and Stu, and the fat guy.
It's really...
We call him Jeffy, but a lot of people just refer to him as Fatso.
In reality on the show, you have a wide selection of fat guys to choose from.
Whichever fat guy you want.
Yeah. He's just the
fat guy that's over there. We're the fat guys over here.
It's really at this point.
A lot of people call us Fatso, too.
Yes, and we are. They're right.
100%. We just ignore that little fact from time to time.
Yeah, it's one of the. That's why
there's no sense in giving too much information, right?
It's like that movie Pop Star, which is not a big hit, but it's an Andy Samberg movie, and he has a Justin Bieber type, but he hires a short person to stand with him so he looks taller, and that's kind of what we would do with Jeffy. Like Jeffy, comparison, we look like we're only pretty fat.
Yeah, like Jeffy would like to have Chris Christie around.
Right, exactly.
So that
that's exactly right. We pointed that out.
In comparison,
what we're saying is you're...
I guess what we're trying to say is that you're overweight. I got it.
By the way, do we have the Grenada tweet by any chance?
I was going to use that in my segment.
Okay, hold up for that. You have to see this tweet from a couple listeners who are fans of Jeffy's military service. Let's put it that way. We'll show you that coming up in the program. I like, as far as tweets go, I like this tweet as well. This is NPR was tweeting some stuff. They tweeted some propaganda. So I would say some anti-Trump propaganda. The Trump fans really reacted to it strongly. And look, this could happen, obviously, with the left as well. But this is why we always say it's important to be educated. It's important to have a foundation, to understand what you're doing, to have some sort of basis some sort of principle in your life. These are the tweets from NPR. Can we show those, please? Here they are. In Congress, July 4th, 1776, this is why you're going to get defunded. Okay. Next, 2241 years ago, the church bells rang out over Philadelphia as the Declaration of Independence was adopted. This is spam. This is just them complaining about the amount of alerts. Do we have the ones where they're actually tweeting the... it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it, to institute new government. NPR is calling for revolution. Interesting way to condone violence while trying to sound patriotic. Your implications are clear. That's just the Declaration of Independence, guys. That's just...
Oh, man.
They're just quoting the document that, July 4th, good day for it.
Yeah, you would think.
Perhaps. Which is, it's an interesting thing when you don't know what the Declaration of Independence says or what it stands for. You're going to be shocked by the...
Or what day it is.
It's incredible. Not the brightest moment. Of course, this would absolutely 100% happen to the left. The difference with the left is they don't say they like the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. In fact, Woodrow Wilson said it was basically a dead letter. It's kind of a little bit of a difference. Really strange story with this Department of Justice, and this is Trump's Department of Justice coming down on Hobby Lobby. One of the strangest stories I'd ever seen before. Apparently, Hobby Lobby, allegedly, was importing stuff from Iraq. Archives, weird, these bizarre things that I guess were
Artifacts?
Yeah, I guess artifacts is what I'm looking for. Strange. So these artifacts from Iraq, and they were importing them in boxes labeled sample. And they imported millions of dollars of these things. And they were all sent to, I guess, their headquarters in Oklahoma. And it seems like Hobby Lobby has kind of admitted this, that they were buying these things. They went from Iraq to, I think, I want to say it was the UAE and through Israel. And then they were importing them, and they were being called samples, when in reality, I guess they were these artifacts that I guess Hobby Lobby wanted to save from the region, like ancient writings and drawings. And the DOJ apparently caught them a couple of times doing it and fined them. And now they are going to have to pay $3 million in fines resolving the civil action.
So what is what was the problem with what they're doing?
I guess they're worried that these things get looted in a war zone and then get exported. So you're not they don't want you importing something that's been looted from a historical site. They, you know, you're not allowed to do that, I guess. These nitpickers. So I guess there's a big business.
So were they actually, Hobby Lobby was doing something illegal? Because I find that hard to believe.
I know, but it seems like
illegal
kind of.
We know these people, and they're not.
That's why I thought it was fascinating.
They're not people that do illegal things.
They're misrepresented.
And who knows what level this was. I don't know. I mean, because it was ancient text, I guess the accusation from some of the left is, and I don't know that this is necessarily shown in the suit, but like they, because of a religious interest, they had an interest in preserving these ancient writings.
Okay, was it somehow illegal, though?
Yeah, it's illegal to import them because it's essentially creating a black market for these things. You go to a historical site in a war zone, take them, and then you can sell them for a lot of money. And they were also being, though, imported in boxes that said samples that were obviously not tile samples. They were we might just sell ancient texts. I don't know if they're saying maybe they were going to base something off of them. I don't know what they were saying, but it's kind of an interesting thing, and I guess they've now settled it. They have to return them all and pay $3 million in fines with Hobby Lobby.
Wow.
Yeah,
it says in the story how they were wiring payments for the artifacts as well. And you may have mentioned it, but to 7 different personal bank accounts other individuals.
It was a little shady.
Mm-hmm.
Shady.
You know, the whole thing was just a little shady.
I would not expect from.
I know.
From Hobby Lobby, from the Green family, they're fantastic Christians who were so, you know, strong in their beliefs that they were willing to be fined $1 million a day by the government for doing what they felt was right. So then. To turn around and do something shady seems out of character.
I mean, it could be that they thought this was right. I would also say, too, I don't necessarily know that it went as high as the level of the Greens. Maybe, you know, had nothing to do with them. I mean,
maybe
just some other employee who thought this was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And now they're settling the suit. But it is a bizarre. What's the reasoning? Is it, do you think, just to preserve history? I mean, because there is obviously. Right in that, right? If you're preserving history and preserving important, potentially religious writings.
You want to do it under the law, though.
But you want to do it under the law.
I would think.
No, not Jeffy. Jeffy would not.
Yeah, if you need to get it out of there. Let's go.
How many bank? I like the bank accounts thing, too. Yeah. Like, you're wiring it to 7 different bank accounts. And the attorney they brought on to look at these said don't do it. They had...
They were warned because they were putting, you know, obviously, as you say, they were putting the wrong country of origin. Coming into the States.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what are you doing, man? Come on.
This is somewhat related.
I mean, we bring stuff into the country all the time from other countries that you ship to one country and then you ship it to another country, then you bring it into the United States. It happens all the time.
Well, it is strange. I was watching War Dogs, which is not a documentary, but is based on a true story. Jonah Hill is in it. It's kind of like a dark comedy, I would say. But it's apparently a true-ish story based on two guys in their early 20s, that somehow won a military bid for $300 million of arms. And they, I guess, started out small and wound up winning this big $300 million arms deal. And they needed to get, I think, AK-47 ammo, which they procured in some... Azerbaijan, it was one of those countries, Croatia. I don't know. It was some country over there, Kazakhstan. I don't know. And it was and so they went and got all this 100 million rounds of AK-47 ammo, and they wanted to ship it. They had to ship it, but they found out after they bought it that it was Chinese, which was illegal. There was an embargo against Chinese ammo, so they had to unpackage it and rebox it and then ship it through multiple sources to try to get this. Of course, the Americans actually realized it and they got arrested. Shockingly, you can't get 100 million rounds past the United States. They wound up noticing. But it's bizarre that, and the guy, I think the guy who headed it was 21 years old.
Wow.
How do you give a 21-year-old a $300 million arms contract? How on earth could that even happen? I'm sure they blew much of it out of proportion. But apparently it is based on
an actual story. It was based on a true story. Yes. They can't lie.
Because it's a true story. It's based on a true story. Right. It's inspired by a true story. Right. There are levels of this. This one was based, though, so you're in the middle there in my book.
I love the inspired by true story, which means you're about to see stuff that's, well, fiction.
Yes, it's basically fiction, but we kind of got the idea.
We told this however we wanted to.
Yes, yeah.
But there's a real person who it really existed at one point that did none of these things.
Yeah.
So that's usually what that means. All right. I guess the History Channel is onto something involving Amelia Earhart. You know, she and her navigator, Fred Noonan, left and tried to circumnavigate the world on their plane. And they disappeared in 1937, and nobody found them since. Well, apparently there's a black and white image, a photo, that has finally been found by the History Channel, and it suggests that Earhart and Noonan survived the plane crash and were captured by the Japanese in 1937. And you can see two people who resemble Earhart and Noonan on a dock with their Lockheed Electra airplane aboard the ship. So the photo kind of backs the theory that the two survived a crash landing in the Marshall Islands. And then the Japanese military took them into custody and held them on the island of Saipan until they died.
I mean, it's a stretch to me to recognize them, obviously. I mean, really can't see anything.
That looks just
two
like her.
Two people resembling them.
What are you talking about?
I mean, how does... You can't tell who that is. You can maybe make out that they're Westerners. I don't know. I can't even do that. Yeah. I mean that's scant proof in my estimation.
Now I guess if you see their plane is their plane here? There's a wing you can kind of see there maybe.
Okay,
but that
maybe.
Seems like a real stretch to me.
It kind of does. Wow.
The lost Amelia Earhart, the lost evidence, airing at 9 p.m.
Still, that's interesting. I mean, you know, everybody's had theories on. I think one of the theories was that they ran off together, she and Noonan.
Oh, really?
And just lived a separate life away from their other people who they were sort of bound to at one point.
Do you understand what they're saying here, Jeffy?
And maybe they left their spouses and went off with each other. And lived on some island and just, you
That's
know.
That's all you got to do is take a plane trip. I'm in. Wait.
Yeah, what would you give? You would stink and die without Amber. She's the only thing keeping you alive.
Well, that and the fat cells.
Well, yes.
For a time. Somewhere, you know, within the 20 to 30 year range, he would survive.
But I've always kind of been fascinated with this case, so I'd probably watch this. And I guess the documentary.
I like this. I was going to promote
airs
it.
On.
Are you doing the same thing? Because it says Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence, airing 9 p.m. July on History.
Yes.
So 9 p.m. Yes. July, just tune in.
All this month.
Just look,
all this month.
Look on the History Channel every night at 9 Eastern.
Eventually it'll be on.
All month.
Just use the search feature on your cable box.
Yeah, I mean, Avery, you should be able to track this stuff down. You have the internet, don't you? I mean, right? Unless you're in the Lumbee tribe or something right now watching, which would be difficult.
Well, and then, you know, you can't search the internet like you like.
Like you like.
No, it'll take a while if you're in the Lumbee tribe, but you still figure it out.
You'll still figure it out. we talked a lot about Charlie Gard today. In fact, spent most of the show on it, really, which is this case. And, you know, it's only one person, and maybe we shouldn't care about it, you know, but this is the type of thing that,
I think we should care about
We
this.
Do care about individuals here in this country, and particularly on this show. And B, It's bigger than that. It really is. I mean, it is. It's the constant degradation of how we treat human life, as if it's just this thing that, you know, it depending on convenience level, you know, you will kind of bypass it and ignore it. They're doing that in England right now. It makes no sense that they wouldn't let the parents take their child and get and at least try for freaking, you know, crazy experimental treatment. What do they have to lose? They themselves are saying the kid has no chance. They themselves are saying it. It's not like this isn't the typical argument. I want experimental therapy, but the doctors say I want you should get chemo. Like, it's not that. It's they're saying this kid has no chance of surviving without us. And they're saying, all right, well, let us try something. Well, you don't have to pay for it. This is one of the most clear-cut examples.
Just give him back to us. We're his parents, and we'll take care of the rest. It's really hard to understand why the hospital would have any problem with that. All right, go ahead. Take him.
Yeah.
Take him.
It goes back to the parent does have the kid. The parent is the state. That's the problem. The parent is not the person who gave birth to them. That is not how that society is set up, and it's a great lesson to not set your society up that way. Mm. Because when you are not the parent, and the state is, they make all the decisions. And you know what? They're, in their system, justified to make those decisions. Whether they're legitimate, logical, or not, they can do whatever they pretty well please because, you know, look, this is a situation where they control the outcome. And if you want, I don't want a society set up that way. I want a society where the parents and individuals make their own decisions. But man, that is not what they have there. You know, there's just this. You know, they talk about the culture of death, and it sounds, I don't know, a little catchphrasy and B, a little dark, I would say. But it really, it's hard to not see it creeping. Mm-hmm. You know, we certainly have people who seem to dedicate their life for the ability to kill children. In the womb, you know, we have people who are, if you're old, if you're young, if you're having severe medical treatment, all these things are now acceptable to end a life. You know, my dad passed away a few years ago, and when we were in the hospital, you know, there was basically no hope, you know, that he was going to recover. But, you know, you still try everything. You know, you just, I don't, you know,
you have to.
Look, you just give it a whirl, and you try as much as you can. And when it came to that point where there was nothing left to try, you know, you're faced with those difficult decisions. And I remember the doctor phrasing something in a really weird way, which was just they said something like, look, you know, we've tried this and it didn't work. And so just so you know, we can't. I can't remember how they phrased it. It was like basically just so you know, we can't just kill him. Like, as if everybody had come in the last few weeks and asked him, can you just, I don't know, inject him with something? Like, I swear, like, that was his perspective.
Really? Oh, man.
As if I was going to say, ah, really? You can't? Darn it.
That's inconvenient for me.
That's really inconvenient. I've got to be here a few more hours now. That was not how I felt.
I was going to play tennis.
That was absolutely not how I felt that night. It was the exact opposite. Because I wanted to know, hey, what's the next crazy? I want you to go three steps beyond what you think is sane.
Yeah.
You know, if after that it still doesn't work, all right, fine. His perspective was more like, you know, people are in here all the time telling me, can you just put a pillow over their face? And then, you know, I can't do that. That was really the way it was phrased. And it's like, God, are people coming in and doing that? And I think the answer to that is yes. I think doctors are actually getting pressure from that side pretty often. Where people just want, you know what, it's been an hour, he's still got the cold, can we end this thing right now?
For me, it's like, well, they signed a DNR, which is do not resuscitate.
Yep.
So? I didn't. Resuscitate them. They didn't know what they're doing.
Yeah, they're stupid.
Resuscitate. So?
It's true.
I mean, you don't want your parents to die.
No,
and,
you don't.
Oof. And even when they do, and they're, you know, they've lived a long life, like my dad was 80 when he died. My mom was 92, and you still don't want them to die. It's like,
no.
Of course you're going to resuscitate. What do you mean, DNR? No. No, she they didn't know what she was saying.
Right.
No.
They made a lot of decisions on my behalf over the years. I'm going to make one for them. No.
Right. No.
It's not apparently how it works. But, yeah, I mean, at least if you have a very, direct thing like that. It makes it a little bit easier because they're, you know, at least requesting it. Again, like, you know, the euthanasia thing is troubling in many ways. The fact that someone who's sick or in great pain can end their life, you're making a final decision in a moment of incredible stress. You know, it's disturbing to me in a lot of ways, but more justifiable in the sense of at least there's a person making a decision. Like, it's a low standard to clear. Here with Charlie Gard, there's no, the kid's not like, you know what, I don't like to travel. I'm not much of a flyer, so I don't really want to go to the United States. If I could just die here, that would be great. That's not what's happening. I mean, this one is so clear cut. I mean,
the parents desperately want their baby to live, and it's they who have to take care of the baby with all of the baby's problems afterward, and they're willing to do all that.
Yeah.
They love him enough to want him to continue life with them.
It's really a heroic story.
It is.
In many ways.
And the dad seems super passionate. I haven't seen much of the mom, but the dad's, you know, he wells up, he cries every time he talks about him and talks about how he'd do anything for him. And it just seemed like loving parents. Let them do what they can for him. I really don't understand. And it's all about control, I think. It's all about control of the state and the state having the final say in everything, and the state being the parents to British children. And that's, you know, we always hear that, well, every other industrialized nation in the world provides government health care for their citizens. Yeah, well, here's the result of that.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. I don't want that. I don't want that because that's not very civilized. I don't care if they're supposedly industrialized. That's pretty backward. To just allow a 10-month-old baby, just unplug him and kill him. It's awful.
It's inhuman, honestly.
It is.
I think a lot of what happens here is that there's a generalized debate that occurs over these sorts of stories, which is, I don't know, should we have medical treatment or should we just let them die? Like, we've done all these things and there's no more to do. And people go into their own categories because that debate has already kind of been mapped out. Everyone knows where they stand on it in these controversial issues. This isn't one of them.
Right.
This is one where they are saying death is certain. The parents are saying, well, let's at least try something. Oh, well, you're going to have them pay for it. Well, they have the money. Well, who's going to do it? No doctor's going to do that. They have a doctor that will do it. But could it make them? They can get worse. You've already said they're going to die.
Yeah.
There's just nothing here.
You can't get worse than dead.
Yeah, dead is dead.
I'm reminded on the feed that England has never had much respect for life. Otherwise, the following would have never been written. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them these are life. Liberty and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, you're right. The country doesn't exist if England respected life. You'd think they'd come around, though, in the last couple hundred years. It would be nice.
Well, that's what makes the United States. You talk about us, we do anything we can, right? I mean, that's why we've pushed so much of medicine beyond what we thought, because we said, no, do what you can.
Yeah. I always
do anything.
The left will make, it's not just the left, a lot of people will make the arguments like, you know, we spend most of the money on healthcare in the last couple of weeks of life when there's basically no chance, and we could solve all these problems if we just stop doing that. You know, I remember talking to a guy several years ago who was an anesthesiologist, really smart guy, and, you know, generally right. Conservative leaning. Like, I don't know how, like, in this era of Trump, I don't know what that means. Like, I haven't talked to him in several years. But this is the point he made. We were talking about healthcare at dinner, and it was, I mean, you know, if you ever want to go out to dinner with me, what an exciting one it is. We're talking about healthcare policy.
Oh, Stu, make that happen.
Well, there's appetizers, there's healthcare policy talk, then there's a dinner, right? You guys do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my point was, like, you can't just let people. These are individuals. And his point, even though he considered himself a Republican, was basically like, look, I'm in these rooms. You know, I'm in these rooms. They just waste so much money on these people who are basically dead anyway. And we just need to stop doing that. And we just stop doing that, and everyone can have health care. And it's tempting, but I think it's honestly a sign of a incredibly wonderful society that we are willing to try to keep people alive because we value every second of that life.
Yeah,
it's a signal that is really positive, and you know, we can't lose that. And it really does feel like we are starting to, at the state level here, certainly, I think, certainly in other countries, humanity itself is losing that. And it's a terrible turn.
Yeah. 888-727-BECK, more patents too, is inevitable.
But they signed the DNI.
So?
I unsign it.
Triple 8727 Beck. It is Pat and Stu. This is some fun stuff.
I think so.
This is fun.
I'm fascinated with. I'm a big documentary guy. First of all, mm-hmm. I like watching them. I like watching sports documentaries. I like the 30 for 30s on ESPN.
Let me ask you. So this is a 30 for 30 on ESPN, right?
It's a new thing they just started. It's called 30 for 30 podcasts. So okay. Now you're getting basically documentaries on sports.
But it's an ESPN.
It's an ESPN product.
Yeah.
But it's only audio, so no pictures. So they just launched this, and you know. ESPN does a good job with these things. They're interesting and in-depth.
Super quality.
Yeah.
It's just that ESPN bends over backwards to be as politically correct as possible.
It is amazing that they go to these lengths.
It's incredible.
Because, you know, the average sports fan, I think, is center-right.
For sure. There's no question about that.
It's not a hardcore left-wing
audience. There have been studies done on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a hardcore right-wing audience either. But
no, but they're not leftists the commentary on ESPN. Always is from these sports guys. Whatever they venture into, anything resembling politics, it's always left-leaning.
Yeah, overwhelmingly so.
Yeah.
I still like their stuff, and I like what they do. And so the first audio podcast they did was this thing called The Trials of Dan and Dave. And if you remember the Dan and Dave thing from the 90s, it really was a huge deal. In 1992...
It was Dan O'Brien... And neither one of them breathed as hard as Jeffy is breathing.
The end of a decathlon.
At the end of the decathlon.
Okay, so Dan and Dave were in the decathlon. And so Reebok...
sorry, I apologize because I was laughing. I just read what you read earlier. And I was laughing. I apologize.
No, okay. No worries.
That's okay.
I know what you were talking about then.
Mm. Got it. Now I understand. Off-air joke, you're never going to get it. Sorry. Okay, so Dan and Dave are going... So Reebok at the time is not even really a legitimate competitor to Nike. They don't really have a big national brand. So they decide to try something crazy. They get, with their ad agency, pick two completely unknown guys, at least unknown to the public. They were very good at the decathlon. One was the...
And they were both world-class at decathletes.
One had just won the world championships. The other one had just won the Goodwill Games or something at the decathlon. Mm-hmm. And they were both expected to do very well in the Olympics, maybe win the gold. Probably win the gold. The way it was presented is one of them was winning the gold. That's the way it was presented. The story goes that basically they started this thing. Is it, you know, who's the greatest athlete in the world, Dan or Dave? You'll decide in Barcelona. And they did these things where, like, Dan and Dave. Dan was, like, this kind of husky white guy. Dave was an African-American guy, kind of more slender. But they were both really good and kind of went at this event in different ways. They go through the entire story. It's a fascinating thing to listen to. But for our perspective, I want to focus on one part. You're talking decathlon. You're talking Olympics. Who are you talking about? Bruce Jenner.
Well,
right?
The greatest American decathlete of all time.
Of all time. Of course, Bruce Jenner is going to come up. So here's a couple times where they're talking about Bruce Jenner. The first one is Dan O'Brien. Listen.
I remember eating lunch with Bruce Jenner, and Bruce kept telling me, only thing people are going to remember is the Olympic Games. And I thought to myself, man, this guy's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He didn't have world championships when he was a competing athlete. I get to compete at world championships every 2 years. But it wasn't until later that I realized, man, Bruce was right.
Bruce was right.
Okay.
Because who was he speaking with at the time?
Bruce Jenner.
Bruce Jenner. What did Bruce Jenner call Bruce Jenner?
Bruce Jenner.
Bruce Jenner, right? Mm-hmm. That was, you know, the name, Bruce Jenner.
That was the guy who won the gold medal.
Right. That is it. That is what the gold medal, that's what the results say.
Yeah.
Right? Bruce Jenner in 1976 was Bruce Jenner. When they had this conversation, his name was Bruce Jenner. His name was Bruce Jenner, right?
Yeah.
Here's Jackie Joyner-Kersee, another amazing Olympic athlete, talking about this as well. Watch.
Well, it's interesting. Jackie Joyner-Kersee made the comment that I could be the next Bruce Jenner. And that was what I was striving to do, you know, most of my career. He was the hero that we all needed in 1976, and he was the golden boy.
And Dan was that very explosive athlete. I mean, he was just this young kid, very raw, you know, very talkative, and he had a personality that could pull people to him.
So, again, Bruce Jenner, right? It's Bruce Jenner. This is the very beginning of the podcast. This is almost the first thing they say in the podcast. This is a story about two Olympic athletes, not Bruce Jenner, two Olympic athletes. Here's how the podcast actually begins.
It's the story of a 1992 Reebok ad campaign 25 years ago this summer, unlike anything anyone had seen before. Reebok spent some $25 million on the campaign, featuring two top decathletes, a sum equal to their entire previous year's marketing budget. Those who remember the story remember it as a bust, but there are many more twists and turns along the way for Reebok, the two athletes, and the sport of track and field.
Interesting.
One note, this episode features references to legendary decathlete Caitlyn Jenner. Jenner prefers to be referred to as Bruce in regards to her decathlon career. And a heads up, this episode includes mature language.
So they go,
and now,
what
the trials
hell?
Of Dan and Dave.
Why?
Decathlete Caitlyn Jenner? There was no decathlete named Caitlyn Jenner.
And it says Caitlyn Jenner prefers to be referred to as Bruce when talking about the decathlon.
So why would you need
why would you point this out?
Wow, that is, I mean, so hypersensitive about offending three people in the country.
Yeah.
That... And why should that offend anybody? Bruce Jenner was Bruce Jenner in 1976.
Yes, it's factual.
And he was a man in 1976. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is just ludicrous.
The standard ESPN is insinuating there is that if Caitlin said, I want you to refer to me in 1976 when you're talking about my 1976 win as Caitlyn Jenner, they would have done it.
Oh, absolutely, they would have done it.
And that would be the
absolutely
right thing
they
to
would
do.
Have done it.
I mean, that's insanity.
And then people will look up, hey, I'm going to look up Caitlyn Jenner because I don't know that story. And you won't find Caitlyn Jenner.
You won't find it because it didn't happen.
In the Olympics. Because Caitlyn Jenner was never in the Olympics.
No.
So.
Bruce Jenner was in the Olympics. And it's like,
Come on, man.
Supposed to put
it's so ridiculous.
Political correctness
above science, above reality,
history.
Above history, above everything. Above everything.
You're right. Science, history, I mean, all of it,
it
falls behind what, this idea that we're supposed to, I guess, make our, and it's really not even about making Caitlyn Jenner feel good or even the three people. It's about us feeling good about ourselves. We're doing something to help this.
Because Bruce Jenner wouldn't, or Caitlyn wouldn't have been offended that Dan and Dave both referred to Caitlyn as him and Bruce in 1976 because that's what he was in 1976.
Like, if you're going to go back...
And she even knows that.
Yeah. I mean, even think of simple name changes. If you once said, say, the early career of Lou Alcindor, the early career of Cassius Clay, that was his name at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he changed it. If you want to talk about it after he changed his name...
And he got pissed when you called him Cassius, when he changed to Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
But that's after.
And I'm sorry, when he was in the Olympics, his name was Cassius Clay.
Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about the Olympics, you'd say, hey, Cassius Clay won this medal.
Right.
You wouldn't say Muhammad Ali won it. If you did say that, it's not the biggest deal in the world.
No.
Either way.
It's not because it's the same person and he's still a man. Still the same guy.
Yeah. To act as if you're supposed to retroactively.
Unbelievable.
Let's be honest about it. If you call him Caitlyn Jenner in 1976, he shouldn't have been in the event. I mean, in mm-hmm. reality, if that's your standard, you should probably take the gold medal away from him. He was a woman competing in the male sport. If yeah. you want to go, if you want to follow this all the way down to the end, you have to pull that medal out of, away. He was not the gold medal winner because he was not a he. You want to call him Caitlyn Jenner in 1976? He is not a gold medal winner. Bruce Jenner won the medal.
The world is bat crap crazy.
It's insane.
And there's more of it coming up in a second.
We should talk about this story with Andrew Klavans when he comes in. Andrew Klavans going to be coming in just a little bit. I'd like to hear his take on that audio because that I don't understand where we're going with this.
Stu, 888-727-BECK. You know, about, what's it been, Stu, 2 years that I saw that article on salt? Because I brought it up because my wife is like, can you bring it? You use it on that salt? Why, you're going to kill yourself using all that salt? And there, the study came out that salt does nothing to you.
Yep.
Nothing. It doesn't raise your blood pressure. It doesn't cause heart attacks. It doesn't, it's not harmful to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that study is wrong.
And so in June last year, the FDA still issued proposed guidelines to the food industry to reduce the amount of sodium in prepared foods. Mm-hmm. The agency noting the average American eats about 3,400 milligrams of sodium a day. That is a lot. That seems
it's
like
really
a lot,
not because
right?
basically the amount of sodium in 1 teaspoon of salt.
Oh, is that all that is?
1 teaspoon.
Wow. And they wanted to cut back to 2,300 milligrams.
Right.
So 1,100 milligrams. So like maybe two-thirds of a teaspoon?
Yeah. They would cut it back by a third, basically.
So here's the problem. Evidence continues to be gathered, and it has been being gathered for years, that government's salt consumption guidelines might well kill more people than they save.
Is that a problem? No, you're saying that's a problem.
Only if you want less people to die.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I don't know if the government's on that bandwagon at this point.
The research does suggest that some subset of Americans may be sensitive to salt and would benefit from consuming less. Among these folks with ancestors from sub-Saharan Africa, which I don't have. So the salt intake is not an issue for me. But for most people, the risk lies elsewhere. There have been more than 24 relevant studies published by the American Journal of Hypertension and concluded that risk of death appeared to be lowest among individuals consuming between 2,565 milligrams and 4,796 milligrams.
Yeah, which is considerably more than the average American eats, and that's the best range. Now, the interesting part about that is they found higher death rates with lower salt intakes.
Yeah, when you go lower than 2,565, right?
Yeah. I think it was, 2,565.
Yeah.
And so the rates went up. So obviously the indication there is not that more salt is killing people. The other side of it is they did find higher death rates than, so the middle ground was the best place to live as far as death rates went.
What a weird thing that moderation.
Moderation in all
would
things,
be good.
Right? Yeah. Now, if you will go extreme and have tons of salt, the rate does increase. However, you have to take into account what that person is doing, which is likely eating a lot more food than they're supposed to be eating. It's not like they're eating, broccoli and then dumping so much salt on it that they wind up dying. It's that they're eating lots of food that is heavy in salt, which might be fast food, which might be, all mm-hmm. sorts of crazy snacks and everything else.
A lot of frozen foods.
Frozen foods very high in sodium at times. But the point is, if you go crazy and you eat lots of anything, you're going to get more salt and go over these limits.
Mm-hmm.
And that does do harm. But no, it's worse or at least as bad to cut salt out of your diet, at least as far as these studies go. The best science indicates, basically, there's not really much of an impact either way. There are other factors that wind up.
You just eat a normal amount of salt.
Yeah.
You put salt
everything
on your corn on the cob, perhaps.
I mean, everything in moderation. That's yeah. That's, I've lived my life.
A little salt on your steak. Mm-hmm. And pretty much I don't add salt to anything but you know, like corn on the cob. Mm-hmm. And we don't have it that much.
This is kind of like your vegetarian thing. Where you're going to start listing like 55 things. It's serious.
I thought this is more real than my vegetarian thing. And steak. I don't do it on roast. I don't do it on any other kind of meat. It's just steak.
Popcorn or chips?
No, I don't. I almost never eat popcorn. I don't like it that much.
No. Yeah. I mean, I will add salt on things. You know, I don't dump it on. But that's not because I'm afraid of the health consequence. It's because I just, you know, salt after a while, you know, it's too much. Like mm-hmm. I don't, you know, mm-hmm. somehow our bodies are designed in a way to like about the right amount of salt. Isn't that weird?
It is.
Isn't that weird how that happens?
Yeah.
Right about the right amount of salt is kind of what we like.
Amazing.
I wish that factored in on every single food-related topic. Because
that's what I was saying. Moderation's due.
You're kind of the spokesperson for moderation.
That's what I was saying. I mean,
you are. I go so far as to say you are moderation.
Thank you.
If you go to moderation.com, it just redirects to Jeffy's Facebook page. That's my understanding of how.
All right. More Patton Stewart coming up in a minute. And the Jeffy segment.
Oh, gosh.
Where he is moderation. So it'll be a moderate segment with moderate stories.
You're
done in
a heavy dose.
Moderate way.
Unfortunately, of Jeffy.
Jeffy found and felt like sharing with us so we don't have to talk anymore.
Oh, jeez. Sorry, man. Whatever. I mean, really?
Hello.
Really? Do we have to do this?
Oh, our bikes are on again.
Oh.
Okay. Hi, Jeffy.
Hey, I'm right. I mean,
yeah, we didn't realize that our mics were on.
Hey, I just wanted to say congratulations to David. David and his new wife. Mm-hmm. They went on their honeymoon.
David who?
To Grenada.
David who?
David Marcarelli.
Marcarelli.
Yes, Marcarelli.
Okay. Yes. Capital A in there. M A R C. Capital A U R L E L E.
There we go.
David Marcarelli. He and his new wife went on their honeymoon after getting married. Congratulations! They're having fun, and they sent me a picture.
This is great.
They sent me a picture. It was so nice of them to send me a picture on Twitter that they're in Grenada. And they were thanking me for liberating it for them. And I just wanted to say, you know, look.
Got to the island of Spice to celebrate our honeymoon today. Thank you for liberating it. That's really funny.
Know, look,
that's great.
I just, look.
That's great.
You didn't
I just
want
to say that, you know, obviously I didn't do it alone.
No.
But
yeah, well, that's true.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And congratulations. I hope you enjoy your honeymoon. Look. Whatever I can do, you know me. You know me. There, we didn't think about, you know, new couples coming for their honeymoon years later, but...
Right. You were thinking freedom, right? I mean, you're just thinking liberty.
I was thinking Western Hemisphere freed from communism.
Yeah, exactly.
What we were thinking.
Exactly.
Is that what you were thinking?
That's what we were thinking.
Is it?
So...
Unbelievable. I just love the idea.
I do, too.
Does he send it to Jeffy, but he gets his wife to actually pose for the photo. Welcome to Grenada to thank Jeffy for liberating the island that he had nothing to do with liberating.
Interesting place to go on a honeymoon. I've never heard of anybody going to Grenada.
Well, it's beautiful. Actually, it's beautiful
supposedly
now.
Supposedly nice, yeah. It's supposedly really nice.
Beautiful now.
You know, it's
beautiful
a tropical
now.
Island, right.
I mean, at the time, it was an ugly place to be.
In 1983, right?
I noticed you didn't put up the tweet that I saw after
18
this,
minutes of hell.
From someone who is actually in the military, who said, I was there that day. It looks a lot nicer than when I was there.
I mean, what did I just get done saying, Stu? Now. It looks beautiful now.
The phrase stolen valor. That's what they call it. Stolen valor. I want you to know that and learn that.
Why would it be stolen? I don't understand.
Do you want to keep going down this road? Because it's just helping me build my case.
What case is that, Stu?
Yeah, you know.
What case is that?
That you're a fraud.
That you're a fraud.
But you got anything else?
Terrible human being. Do you have anything else? You have this. We want to do this robot burger joint video, too. Do you have that?
I don't. We could do that. That's why I figured that we would save that because she had that on another segment, I thought.
Okay.
For us, which is great.
Well, if you have more, do it.
But I wanted to also give a Colin Kaepernick update.
Oh, yeah.
Colin, we like to let you know what he's up to. He's still unsigned.
Yes.
In the NFL.
Not a lot of prospects.
Which is why, he's not really busy.
Mm-hmm.
able to travel, which is why he sent out his Instagram and Twitter account over the 4th of July. Hey, how can we truly celebrate independence on a day that intentionally robbed our ancestors of theirs? To find my independence, I went home. He went back to Ghana.
He was born in Ghana?
Apparently that's where his ancestors are, yeah.
Oh, his ancestors.
Look, he wrote in an extended post in a quest to find his personal independence. Had to find out where my ancestors came from, and I set out tracing my African ancestral roots. That led me to Ghana. And
on a day that intentionally, go back to that if you would. I have to read that.
On a day that intentionally robbed our ancestors of theirs. Now, I will say this. Look, if Colin's intention, and good for him, if he wants to find his family, his ancestral roots, and where, you know, where he came from and his bloodline and all that, good for you, Colin.
I just can't stand
it. But I will say that commenting like that may lead to
being unemployed in the NFL.
People, you know, like Blaine Gabbert signing a deal before you.
Yes. And every other unemployed quarterback, who, frankly, many of them not as talented as that guy.
Right.
And let's be clear.
Nobody wants anything to do with him because he's a pariah now.
He lost his job to Blaine Gabbert before he did anything on this run. Let's remember
that. True.
Right.
But beyond that, like, he's made his choice, right? Like, the choice is, are you going to dedicate yourself to football, or are you going to dedicate yourself to being some crazy activist? And he's decided he's going to be an activist.
He's going to be an activist. Good for you.
Good riddance. Good for any NFL team
but
that doesn't have to worry
about having a job in the NFL.
And look into how slavery started. Because it didn't start here.
They never had it in Ghana,
white people.
They never had it in Ghana, right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. But wait a minute. Yeah. I thought we stole their independence.
No.
No? Welcome back. 888-727 Beck is our phone number. Very excited. So welcome to the program, Andrew Klavan. We have Andrew?
Uh-oh.
No mic? Jeffy?
Jeffy, you want to see if his mic's on?
Jeffy ate his microphone. That was a problem.
Sometimes it's not turned up
This is the sound. This is the sound.
No, I think he's on now.
No.
Yeah, he's on.
No?
Yeah.
All right. Andrew, welcome to the program.
I'm still here.
The big welcome did not go well, but we tried it. We tried a big introduction.
It's kind of a letdown.
Sorry about that.
No, I'm sort of depressed. I don't know.
I'm not sure he's on still. That was your microphone. Why don't you give him your microphone and maybe we can make that work? Good golly.
Our budget for the entire year is $9.
Yeah. And we already spent it, so there's no room for another microphone.
Yeah. Right.
You know, they cost over $8.50.
Clip that on. Just don't walk too far away because I don't want to be pulled off.
Oh, right.
Can you now hear me?
Yes, okay, we can.
Let's try this
now surprisingly.
We're really excited to bring on the show Andrew Klavan.
Yay!
How are you doing? It's great to be here.
Great to see you. Thanks so much for coming on, man. We're so glad you're in town.
It's a pleasure.
You know, we were talking a little bit about just the media in general, and I know you've done some great stuff on this. Let me start you here with ESPN, though.
Okay.
You know, we're big sports fans. You know, ESPN, it's part of my childhood. It's been part of my entire life watching. I'm basically obsessed with sports. I just can't take the constant political correctness that comes out of this in a realm where I don't want it.
Right.
I want to escape.
I mean, how hard is it to tell me the score and what the guy, you know, the sports interview is, it's a team sport, you know, I take it one day at a time. It's the same interview every time. How hard is it to stick to that script and not tell me, you know, the title nine is the greatest thing ever? I actually canceled my subscription to Sports Illustrated because I was so tired of them telling me that God didn't care who won the Super Bowl. You know, it's like how do they know? Maybe God has money on the Super Bowl. Right. And when did Sports Illustrated become, you know, the center of theology in America?
It is amazing because you really see it all the time. Title IX is a great example of that.
Title IX and its resulting nonsense because they've bent over backward in this John McEnroe scandal in the last couple of weeks to make it seem as though he said something horrifically terrible and shocking to everybody that a woman, the highest ranked woman in the world, would only be 700th on the men's tour. I mean, I'm not even sure she'd be 700th.
She says the same thing.
She said about a few years ago, she said the exact same thing.
That she would never be able to beat Andy Murray. But you know what? It's just plain to see. It's not even a controversy. But now they make it like he's supposed to. It's like a show trial, a Stalin show trial. He's supposed to show up and apologize. It's really, really strange, because the whole point of women's tennis, the reason women's tennis is one of the only popular female sports, is because it's different than men's tennis. There's not as much power. It's more strategy. It's a little slower.
Longer rallies.
Yeah. That's what makes it so interesting. Yeah. And the short skirts.
I do actually find it, for both of those reasons, preferable to watch, because, men's tennis winds up being guys who hit the ball 145 miles an hour on serves, and there's just not a lot happening. Women's tennis, there's back and forth. It's actually a really interesting part of the sport, though it is the same sport. Let's be honest. They put them all together. It is the same sport. They play it differently. But the bottom line is, if Serena played in men's tennis, I don't think she would be 700th. I think she probably would lose to the 700th best player in the world.
It's very, very, very possible. That power just overwhelms everything. It's one of the reasons that men's tennis can get very boring.
Yeah, it really can. So we were talking a little about this Caitlyn Jenner thing as it relates to ESPN. They did a 30 for 30 podcast. And the 30 for 30 podcast was about the Dan and Dave ad campaign that they ran in the 90s. I don't know if you remember this, but it was a big deal at the time. These two competing decathletes, and they ran the ads constantly. Okay. So it's an interesting story. If you want to go back and listen to it at some point, it's worth it. However, they started with this disclaimer at the beginning of it, because we're talking to decathlon. Of course, Bruce Jenner is going to come up. This is the actual disclaimer they get at the beginning of this podcast. Listen.
It's the story of a 1992 Reebok ad campaign 25 years ago this summer, unlike anything anyone had seen before. Reebok spent some $25 million on the campaign, featuring two top decathletes, a sum equal to their entire previous year's marketing budget. Those who remember the story remember it as a bust, but there are many more twists and turns along the way for Reebok, the two athletes, and the sport of track and field. One note, this episode features references to legendary decathlete Caitlyn Jenner. Jenner prefers to be referred to as Bruce in regards to her decathlon career. And a heads up, this episode includes mature language. And now, the trials of Dan and Dave.
Yeah,
mature language.
There was no legendary decathlete named Caitlyn Jenner. So that's how politically correct they get. They're trying to rewrite history, even though Caitlyn herself prefers to be referred to as Bruce when she was a he. I mean,
it's impossible. Like, they actually want to deny history and say the person, they want to say a woman won the men's decathlon in 1976.
Well, you're being kind when you say they want to deny history. They want to deny all reality. I mean, all reality is going to bend to their will. I mean, this is what political correctness is. Political correctness is the theory that if you lie, reality will shape itself around your lie. And you know, to be honest with you, it really is kind of a problem, because when the Olympic Committee starts to say that a transgender male can compete against females, these women who spend their lives training and working to win suddenly are really up against the man.
Yeah, and I think that might be the breaking point for this bull crap. I think when men start saying, I identify as woman, and they get into women's sports and they start beating these women, the women are going to get pissed and they're going to rise up and maybe put a stop to it. And maybe it's only women who can put a stop to this.
Because they have their own
beef. Their own special interest group that's pretty powerful.
It is amazing. So let's bring this to the media more generally, because there's this, the term fake news. You have a great Prager University video about fake news. And it's interesting the way that term has kind of developed in a really short amount of time. I mean, it came out of initially seemingly to describe sort of like internet hoaxes. It had nothing to do with politics at all, kind of initially, when people started saying fake news. And then it was kind of tied, the left tried to use it to blame Trump's victory on people fooling them on Facebook, which was a ridiculous way to do it. You kind of broaden it, and because political correctness is not just a thing that you can apply to a Caitlyn Jenner story or to a Serena Williams story. It's just, it really is the media as a whole looking at these stories from a completely different perspective from the truth. They're biased.
That's right.
And that that really fuels all their coverage.
Well, the bias is so bad that all the news is essentially fake. And, you know, this is the delight about this is fake news was kind of a term, as you say, that the left was throwing at places like Breitbart, the Trump places.
Right. Yeah.
And it kind of was like a cigar that blew up in their faces. They were puffing away
really
and suddenly,
is.
Boom,
yeah.
You know. And I think the problem is, look, for 16 years during the George W. Bush administration and during the Obama administration, that small swath of America that fits between New York and L.A., you know, like all of it, you know,
noticed a little
was,
bit there.
Was just consistently derided and disrespected. The Tea Party was absolutely dismissed. They were called names. They're perfectly peaceful and honorable protests against the government spending were depicted as racist. Mm-hmm. And this went on and on. And Barack Obama went for 8 years. He corrupted the Justice Department. He corrupted the IRS. He had scandal after scandal that they never covered. And then at the end, there's a wonderful clip you can find of every single network going, the remarkable thing about Obama is that he was scandal-free.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, yeah, he's scandal. I couldn't see the scandal. You know, I had my hands over my face. So this basically has been saying to most of America that your opinions are hateful. There's our opinions, our progressive, beautiful, mm-hmm. you know, futuristic opinions, and then there's your backlash against our brilliant tomorrow, and you're hateful. And this went on and on and on, and then finally Trump got elected, and the press went nuts. And so now they've gotten so excited trying to get him that it really is fake news. The Russia collusion story mm-hmm. is fake news. They're just lying all the time. Mm-hmm. Jim Acosta just, I now call it the CNN two-step. The first step is you put your foot in your mouth. And the second step is you shoot yourself in the foot. You know, blow your head off. You know, and Jim Acosta today was Trump was in Poland and he said pointed out that they keep saying that all 17 intelligence agencies signed off on this Russia interference thing, and it's just not true. And the New York Times and AP retracted it.
Yeah, last week, right?
And, right. Yeah, and Donald Trump pointed this out, and Jim Acosta says, well, there's fake news. Mm. You know, where did he get that number that it was only three agencies? Well, he got it from the New York Times,
yeah.
the Associated Press. So they just keep blowing themselves up
wow.
because they hate him so much. And the thing is, you know, this thing with Trump and his mean tweets against the press, this is not a bug, it's a feature. I mean, this is one of the reasons people sent Donald Trump to Washington, D.C., was to just kick back against these people that they have no voice against. They're too powerful. Their voices are too broad, and they just wanted to strike back.
I think if Republicans in general could be just a tad more competent,
yeah.
there's a real opportunity here in that Trump is able, unlike anybody ever, to completely derail the media coverage by 140 characters.
Right.
So he can tweet out a picture, and you might say, is this the right thing for the president to be doing? Those criticisms, I think, are legitimate. However, it distracts the media so much. You could pass anything in Congress. You could pass a flat tax of 1% if he tweeted at the right moment. Like, they should start using this as a strategy to just throw people off the line of policy. I don't know if that's their goal, but, man, it would be great if it was.
Well, it is. I agree with you that it's disturbing to watch the presidency kind of devolve into this mud fight. But at the same time, when you have Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough week after week calling this man a goon, a thug, mentally ill, an ass, they called him all those things. And finally he says, you know, shut up. And then they go, what? You know,
yeah,
like presidential is a word that now the news media uses to mean you can't strike back at us. And I thought it was a perfectly legitimate hit. They've been lying about him for 6 months.
There was another example of this type of behavior with Trump, who's doing this big kind of global tour right now and the G20 and all of this. He talked about North Korea and China and how the trade levels had gone up by 40% in the first quarter. I think his exact phrasing was almost 40%.
Right.
He gets this fact checked by, I think it was the New York Times, who in the story show that the trade had increased by 37.4%. And he said almost 40%. And they say in the story, we don't know where he got this 40% number.
Wow. Wow, I haven't seen that. That's amazing. Yeah.
You know, because I think there are two ways to go in this. I think you can be like the left is. They just believe everything they say, and they never question anything the media, you know, actually says. And I think there are some on the right that just take everything that the media says and just throw it out.
Right.
And while you say, everything in the media is fake news, it's really what you're saying is the perspective.
That's
is,
right. It's not the facts. And, right. and one of the things that's so disturbing is the New York Times has wonderful reporters on it.
Yeah.
CBS has some good reporters. A lot of these places have good reporters. But they're being put to use serving what is essentially propaganda. The New York Times has now become a college sophomore left-wing paper. I mean, it is so bad. It is so hysterical, so shrill, that you read it and you think, like, yeah, they're sending this excellent reporter out into the field. But then when it gets to the editorial level, they're using his material in a very, very skewed, ridiculous way. And I can't blame people for dismissing them, even though I agree there's a hazard to dismissing the facts.
You know? It's an interesting thing. In a way, it's understandable, too. I mean, here is a group of people that live around people who are all the exact same as them. They're all far to the left. They were all going through the same sort of systems. They all believe the exact same things. Then they are in control of the media. They say all the things they want to say, and they still lose. And I think some of these, especially some of these extreme examples, the Acosta one seems to be a good one from today, might be just a part of them. They can't believe the world they live in. And they're becoming activists even more than they were previously because they think the whole world is slipping away. Yeah. And in some ways it is. I don't know what it's slipping away to, but it's something else. And it's not excusable, but do you think that that could be potentially the formulation that's going on with
them? Well, I think they truly don't know what they don't know. I mean, they are so, they're, not only are they in their bubble, but they can't even see beyond, they can't even see the worth of getting out of their bubble. And, you know, they have been saying this for years. Every time they're challenged on this, they say, well, you know, I may be a Democrat, and every single person around me may be but a Democrat can be fair. And of course, that's technically true. But a Democrat can be fair when a Republican is standing next to him. Same is true of a Republican, by the way. It's not that. It's just psychologically, when you're surrounded by people who agree with you, you become biased and you become kind of radicalized because everybody is confirming everything that you say. And it's just, it happens to everybody. And I think that it is a problem in the whole country now that we're so, we're in such niches and cut off from one another that we don't really, just, you know, it's so funny. When I meet leftists and we talk face to face and I don't call them names and I don't attack their heroes and all this stuff, we can have very good conversations. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about principle and we say, well, yeah, I can agree with you there and I disagree with you here and here's why. But you can't do that when all you ever see is the news from your side. And I think the right has an advantage here because we don't own ABC, CBS, and NBC. They do. We don't own the New York Times, which sets the budget, you know, of most of the small newspapers sure. throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So, and we don't own Hollywood. We don't, the movies reflect their values, not ours. So we see what they think. We know what they think, and we can reason against it and argue with it in our minds. They never hear what we think. When I talk to liberals, the first thing I say is, you don't know what I think. You have no idea what my first principles are or what, you know, I know what you think, but you don't know. And it turns out they agree with me by the end of it. We didn't know. We didn't know what you were going to say because they make us into cliches. They make us into, jokes, basically.
Yeah, it's an amazing, and I think the problem you're talking about does get worse when you talk about social media. You can really get to that point on Facebook where you never see the other side. Unless it's characterized as like, do you believe what this leftist said? Or do you believe what this crazy Nazi conservative said? You will never leave that bubble. And I feel like that's an annoying sort of thing to say, like, oh, we're all so polarized and we're all in our own bubbles. But it's really true.
Yeah.
I mean, I people that I deal with on a regular basis who I really consider to be smart people who, you know, we're not talking about, you know, Cletus from The Simpsons here. We're talking about people who really like, you know, I think are really smart and agree with the world. And they don't even investigate the other side. And I think what makes you strong and principled on the right is understanding what the left wants to do.
Right.
If you don't understand that bigger picture, you can't possibly get to a real principled position.
You know, I tell this story, but it's absolutely true that, you know, they give you those news apps you get on iPad and all this,
yeah.
and they filter your news according to what you like. And I was reading it one day, and finally it was only turning up articles written by me. I thought I'm now literally talking to myself, you know? And it would be nice if they would invent an app that would, put in stories that disagree with you, that say, well, here's the other side of that. You know, I go to places like realclearpolitics.com, which give you the best op-eds from both sides and all that stuff. But it's hard to do, and you got to work at it, and you have to get over your anger when you read an opinion that you don't like, and you have to kind of calm down and see where the guy is coming from. It's work.
Speaking of things you've written, tell us about your latest book, The Great Good Thing.
Yeah, it's a memoir of my conversion from, I hate to call it secular Judaism because there's no such thing really, but I was a secular Jew. I was raised a Jew. I became a complete agnostic for most of my life. I mean, I was close to 50 when I was baptized. So it was really, it was a really long journey. Well, you know, you live in an atmosphere, it's like the fish in the sea. They don't know they're in the sea because it's everything around them. And that was where I was. I worked in L.A. I worked in the movie business. I was a novelist. I worked in New York. I lived in London. Everyone around me had the same opinion that if you believed in God, you were kind of offbeat. If you believed in Christ, you were out of your mind, and you were kind of an idiot. You know, that was basically the idea. And so it took a long time of just thinking. Reason, I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't looking for anything. I was just kind of trying to reason out the truth according to all the things I'd read and all the philosophy and literature and everything. And it just kept coming back to this experience. And of course, through that, my own life, I've lived two lives. It's very weird. I mean, people who know me now get sick and tired of how joyful and upbeat I am. But until I was 28, I was out of my mind. Mm. I was like a nut, you know, and like I really cracked up at that point. And there's a dividing line. Mm. And it was only when because I was so unhappy, I wouldn't turn to God because it felt like a crutch. And so I thought, like, that would be intellectually dishonest. So I actually had to get happy first. And then I started to think clearly about it. It's actually, I have to say, when I wrote it down, one of the reasons I wrote it down was to make sure I hadn't made any mistakes. But it turned out to be a really good story. I didn't realize my life was actually as good a story as it was. As I was writing, I was going, hey, this is pretty good, you know? So it's actually kind of an interesting journey.
What was the turning point for you in your faith?
Well, you know what? Some Christians actually get angry about this with me because I didn't have like a road to Damascus moment. There was nothing like this beam of light or anything like that. But two basic things happened. One was I slowly began to realize that nothing I believed made sense without God. None of the morality, I believe, made sense without God. I had grown up surrounded by this idea of relativism, that you have your morality, I have my morality. And I slowly realized that just does not make sense. That is not the world as I see it. You know, there are certain things you could do that would be wrong if every single person on earth said it was right. And I thought, like, you can't have that opinion without believing in God. And so I sort of stumbled into prayer. And the prayer changed my life so much that I eventually went to God and said, well, how do I thank you? You know, I'm like, you're God, I'm a schmo. You know, what do I do for you? And I won't say it was a voice, like an actual voice, but it was as clear as day, this idea, now you should be baptized. And my reaction was, are you kidding me? You know, like what, I'm working in Hollywood, they'll crucify me, you know, never mind you, you know, it's like, and you know, my family will be upset and my father will disown me and all this stuff. So it was a very difficult moment, and I had to go over my entire life and think like, why that? Why me, you know? And that's kind of the story I tell in the book, was that kind of 5 months of just struggling with this idea that seemed to have come out of literally out of the sky.
There's some real value in that type of introspective thinking, too. I mean, you know, Glenn always uses the quote from Thomas Jefferson, question even the very existence of God. And you know, there's more to it than that. I won't bore the audience with the entire quote, because if they listen to this network, they've heard it 500 million times. But the point is, though, that is a tough thing to question. If you grow up in a certain faith, if you grow up not believing in God at all, to consider those things, I think, takes real introspection. And that can be applied to every aspect of life. I mean, politics is easy once you've kind of gone through that journey, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's right. And, the funny thing is, getting baptized brought me so much peace and so much joy and really elevated my life in so many ways that one of my complaints that I sometimes would take to God is, why did you take so long? Why did you let me wander around like an idiot for 50 years? You know, like it's not that long a journey, you know, it's not that hard an idea to get. And one of the reasons I think that had to happen to me was I had to see all the bad arguments. I had to live out all the bad arguments. And one of the reasons that's an advantage is many people who are born into the faith and stay in the faith don't understand why people don't just see it. And mm-hmm. they'll say, but don't you see it's right here in the Bible? The guy says, well, I don't believe in the Bible. That's not an actual argument. You know? Right. And so to have built my faith up from the ground up without the Bible, really, to have to get to the Bible, actually makes it very strong. So when I hear certain arguments, I can think like, yeah, I've been there. I believed that for a while. And then that fell apart on this, you know, that hit this rock. And it actually has been very useful that way.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Andrew Clavin, I mean, we're really happy to have you here.
It's a thrill. Yeah.
It was great. Daily Wire, the podcast, you can get there, right?
Yep.
And I mean, that's a, you know, you're talking about a great, great place to show up. You got you got Ben Shapiro, all the, you know, they cover every bit of news as well. It's a great place to go. And you can get it. It's every day, right? Monday through Friday?
Monday through Thursday.
Monday through Thursday.
Okay. And the name of the book, of course, is The Great Good Thing. Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. So
awesome.
Pick that
get
up
it.
Too.
Andrew
Thanks
Clavin,
very much.
Thanks so much for coming on.
It's great.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Thanks.
Back in a second.
888-727 back. More. Come on.
That's great. Hello, 888-727
Beck. There was something that we didn't get to last hour that I thought might be interesting.
Was it the video of the robot? I did want to see that one. Do we have the robot burger
thing?
Can we start there and you can find whatever you were talking about? Here's a, I don't know, I guess, you want to talk about your $15 minimum wage? Watch this video and then come back to me, Bernie Sanders, and tell me what's going to happen to those jobs if you really get your $15 minimum wage. Watch.
Keeps track of each burger's cook time and temperature. That's great. It alerts human cooks when it's time to apply cheese or other toppings.
And that job's going away, too. They're going to figure out how to pick up
cheese. Wow. Darn right they are.
Digital systems send tickets from the counter back to the kitchen. Wow.
So it's even, I mean,
moves burgers from the grill, can't wrap them or add finishing touches yet.
Yet.
Okay. So it can't put ketchup on it or whatever.
But again, that's easy. I mean, that's an assembly line. You could do that.
Wow.
You could actually, like, see the chicken, difference between a chicken sandwich and a burger. Eventually, the software will enable, I mean, they can do everything from cutting the vegetables to, I mean, this is pretty impressive. They're going to put it in its restaurants by 2018.
That looks pretty good. I mean, that's, why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't
well, because
you
you'd want a human and you'd want to pay that human
no, you
$20
really don't.
An
you
hour
really don't.
And pay their insurance and make sure that they are able to provide for their 8-children family. By
no, you really don't. You really don't want to pay a human $15 an hour to do what this robot can do for $0 an hour. You'd be pay the initial fee, whatever it costs. Let's say it's $5,000. Then you're done.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so now what? I have to go up to a computer kiosk and punch in my order? Without talking to a human, and then have a robot make my burgers.
That's another thing I don't have to pay for.
And then have it delivered to the front counter so I can't talk to anyone?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
First of all, I'm 100% behind that, what you just described.
Me too.
I want to happen so badly.
I love that.
But it's also a situation where you could probably make one of those places with no employees at all.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you could get eventually, and you're probably a few years away from that. But like, if you think of like, they have now, have you ever seen these places? They're around in Texas. And you know how they're like ice huts? It's like a hut. It's like there's no employees there. It's just an automated ice vending machine where you can buy ice.
Yeah, they've had them. Yes.
Which is, to me, like this is an entire business, right? Where water's going in, it's freezing all automatically. You're pressing a button, it's all coming out. It's, you know, they obviously have them with vacuums and they have them to vacuum your car. They have car washes where you could do it all automated. You're going to get to the point where your food's coming out this way, where they're cooking it fresh. You'll probably get it even more fresh than you do now because it'll all be timed perfectly to when you pull up to the window.
Plus, when you order something medium rare, it'll be medium rare because that senses the right temperature and then stops cooking it.
What happens when it's not, Pat? Who are you going to complain to?
I'm just not going to go there anymore if they can't get it right.
Right.
I'll go somewhere else.
You'll probably, at least at the beginning, have one employee to fix problems, right? Eventually. Yeah. But eventually it probably gets to a point where you need it.
Absolutely. You're going to end up with maybe one or two people overseeing it. I mean, you have to have, at some point, unlike your ice machines. You have to have, I mean, the human does have to come and make sure everything is working properly.
Yeah,
and upkeep and
that,
what have you.
That goes away over time. Over time, these the systems get perfected. And you, I mean, but even if you're going from 30 jobs to one, I mean, again, this is the ramification of jacking up these minimum wages.
And you have
McDonald's just started this. Yeah. They just started putting kiosks in their restaurants.
I was thinking too, is that,
and I
you
love
know, you
that.
Think about the one guy at a restaurant with the chains. You have one person sitting in his office that was remodeled from his garage at home, and if something breaks down at store 232,
he goes to
you call Bill, and Bill shows up at 232 and
just
fixes
like a vending
it.
Machine. A vending machine as it goes out of order, and it's offline, so that restaurant closes for a couple of hours, but so what? Have you ever been to a restaurant with a kiosk only, like Panera has them, is an example I would think about around here. Have you had that awkward moment where you walk in and there's no one in the store and there's someone behind the counter and you still choose the kiosk?
Oh, I go to the human every time, though. See that?
Of course you would.
I do not. No.
Kiosk every time.
And it's not awkward to me. I don't care.
I would rather talk to the human.
I don't care.
At some point, I'll be like pressing a button and it's like not working and I'm like, ugh, and the person actually one time said to me, I can actually take your order here, sir, if it's not working. I'm like, no, I'll get it to work. I'd rather solve the technology issue than speak with you.
Yes.
See, there's not. So, I am exactly the opposite.
You really are, aren't
you? Yeah, I am. Why? If you won't go to the store and no one's there, and you have someone that you can mess around with behind the counter, come on.
That's not what you're supposed to do with them. You're not supposed to mess around with them.
No, I mean, have a conversation.
This is, I mean, in all seriousness, here is the most unlikable person in America, and he's the guy who wants to talk to people the most. That's why our country's screwed up.
He likes to hassle people.
Yes.
He loves it. He lives for it. And then people wonder, why are you so mean to Jeffy? He's just a terrible human being.
He's awful.
That's why.
He's awful. That's why. So. We're actually nice to him in relation to how we should be. And people bust on us all the time.
You believe that, don't you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. Speaking of new technology, though, the Tesla Model 3 is coming out, and here's a look. Here's a quick peek. Model 3 revealed July 2017. That's now. Everything you need to know about the car coming up. It'll come in four colors: red, silver, metallic gray, and black. Man, I love the way Tesla looks. Relatively low starting price of $35,000.
I'm not crazy about the look of this one.
I don't like this one. Yeah, that's before tax incentives, of course, so you'll pay, what, $28,000? With extra add-ons, price will likely top $40,000. Although, again, doesn't include the government thing.
Right.
215 miles on charge.
0 to 60 in under six. Musk has said more expensive versions will go even faster. Yeah, this is one of those suite of sensors. Regulations are loosened. The car could drive itself. Huh. Access to the largest supercharger network ever. That's not saying much.
Oh, yeah, it is. Look at that. Because I just watched a story, and I'll tell you when this video is done. But that's a big network.
It has no grill. Doesn't need one, of course. The handles are also flush with the door. Oh, that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool. I don't like the look of this one, though. It's squatty and...
Yeah.
It's no grill. How are you going to eat? You can't cook anything.
No, you don't have a grill in the... Forget it.
And they have the gigantic screen like all Teslas do.
I actually don't like the screen that
you don't?
The Teslas. It's too big. It really is. It looks like they just stapled an iPad to the front of it. I mean, it's not my favorite part of that car.
Yeah. Mercedes has I drove a Mercedes for a while that someone else owned, and they have a nice, pretty good size screen on them.
Is that
dashboard.
Your way of saying you stole a car?
I drove a car for a while that somebody else owned. Yeah, that's a pretty nice screen.
And the police called it Grand Theft Auto.
They don't call it that if they don't know.
More anyway. Patents still coming up inside. Yesterday, I made a grave error, and I'd like to apologize for that now. On yesterday's episode of Spoons, we featured the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup
with white milk chocolate, white chocolate. And at the time, I don't know if I was in a bad mood. I don't know if it just, I was being flippant, maybe in a hurry to get the episode over with so we could get the hell out of here. But I gave that cup a 12 on the scale of 1 to 18. Mm-hmm. A horrible injustice was done. That's at least a 15 or 16 product. And I just want to apologize to Reese's and its parent company, Mars or Hershey or whoever makes them.
Nestle, maybe?
Nestle. I don't
know.
I'm sorry.
They really should be their own parent company. Do they have a parent company? Reese's really should just own
maybe
it.
Reese's is just Reese's.
Okay. Reese's.
You know, it's that big.
Mm-hmm. It's a Hershey.
But, yeah, that, Hershey. That is a 15 or 16 product.
That was really freaking good.
It was delicious.
Yeah, and
it was way hasty.
A really, I guess I just say it, brave moment there.
Thank you.
From you, Pat. I mean, because it's
we've
it's
always
difficult.
Said we lead with our mistakes.
Yep. And we do.
And we do.
And now it's time for today's spoons, which is kind of actually related. We're very excited today to bring back another product from the fine Reese's company. Hopefully, Pat will
That's
not.
That's how sorry I was. Let's bring another Reese's
bring
product
something
in.
Something else. It's not because we want to eat another Reese's product. People are probably thinking that we wanted
to
eat another Reese's, and absolutely not. How much time do we have here, Lee? We have 1 minute.
We better get into it then.
These are the big and crunchy cups. Is that right?
Look at the size of that cup.
Oh, yeah. That's
huge.
That's the right size.
It's massive. That's like 3 pounds. Maybe 4.
Size isn't always better, though, on this stuff. You know?
I'm not.
It's about the ratio.
A huge chunky fan, though.
Oh, yeah. Chunky peanut butter.
I don't know.
I'll tell you what.
Got the peanuts in the peanut butter.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad.
Is this the first time they've done that?
I don't know, but I like it. I will say this. The peanut butter ratio on the big cup is excellent.
It's still good.
A lot more peanut butter. Inside,
yeah.
There are a few peanuts.
There's more chocolate. There's more peanut butter. And then usually I don't like peanuts in a product, but I got to say I'm not going to be hasty this time.
Mm.
I'm not in a bad mood today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give this a 15.
I'm going to go up. And again, the scale is 1 to 18. I'm going to give this a 16, and I might have a non-air apology to give it a 17 tomorrow. Back with more in just a second. Oh, these are good, man. Season finale, Wonderful World of Stew, tomorrow night, 8 p.m., this network. Watch
already?
It or die.
How short is your season? Like 12?
How
two,
short? What
two
the
episodes?
Heck? You don't
no,
even
I
do
like
any
three,
show.
Right? 10 or 11.
What the hell?
Be like 20-something a year. Glenn does a little bit more
no
than that
way.
On Think Tank.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about the stuff going on in the Middle East. Not quite as good as Wonderful World of Stew, but watch.
Let's go to the Middle East, because the Middle East, we have to play Risk. Do you remember Risk?
Game of Risk, yeah.
Yeah. We have to, next week, maybe let's do our own board of Risk and put in who the allies are if this starts to break apart, because who actually has the money to be able to fund a global war? Who has it?
And issue number 5, if Turkey's out, what does that do to NATO? We can't automatically count on.
Well,
right?
Look how close NATO was to electing somebody who said they're going to change their alliance from NATO to Russia in France.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
And the whole point of NATO, Article 5 says you attack one, you attack all of us, and we all line up against you.
What if
that may be done?
If NATO attacks the others.
Yeah, right, exactly. And how does that affect with a president who has not supported NATO as much?
Who supports who and who is allied with who? It's so confusing right now because it's based off of a system from after, like, what, 1948, 1949?
Oh, yeah.
The purpose of NATO is not collective, you know, defense. It's the purpose is to stop the Soviet Union. They don't
exist
anymore.
Right.
It does not exist. So NATO is there, and they don't even know what they want anymore. Yeah. So now you have Western Europe. Their interests don't align with somebody from Eastern Europe, like, say, from someone from Poland or whatever. I mean, we support Poland now more than we actually support, you know, other countries like France or Germany, especially Germany right now.
Tell me, did anybody see what happened in Sweden this weekend, that they're now talking about that they are in a cold civil war now, and they believe that a hot civil war is going to break out, and they believe they are done? I was reading some stuff on Sweden. You know, we were just there. Were you with me, Jason? Mm-hmm. I was just there last year, and everybody said, why are you going to Sweden? Why are you going to Sweden?
because Sweden is going to be a very important hot key in the future. And just this weekend, I'm reading that there is such a split between, and they've hit the tipping point, between the refugees coming in who want nothing to do with the Swedish culture and the Swedish culture. And then the government, right in between the two, not promoting the Swedish culture. And the people are hitting the Bubba effect point, where it's getting bad.
It's interesting. It actually will be a barometer. Those Scandinavian countries, they're the first ones that let in tons and tons of refugees, without even thinking about it, and they're the ones are the first ones that adopted full-on, basically socialist-type principles.
Yes.
So all of those are about to come to a head.
They're all collapsing. All collapsing. And the problem with Sweden and all those Norwegian countries is they were so homogenized that it's easy to keep people on the same page because you're all pretty much alike. And so they kept everybody on the same page. Now that's not true. It's starting to come apart. They look at themselves as the refugee home of the world. They look at themselves as more enlightened than the rest of the world. And I mean, you know, they were tremendous in World War II. What happens when they realize, uh-oh, we may have just dug ourselves a grave? It's frightening.
So we need to tell their stories.
Yeah. So here's the deal. So next week we'll start with risk, but we have to look at the countries that we would say are allies. What is the refugee population? How is that being handled in each country? And what is their ratio to debt? GDP ratio to debt. How far over the cliff are they? Who can afford a global war right now? I mean,
nobody can. That's the problem.
Right. No, that may be the savior. Yeah. That's the fourth piece. Yeah. That's the fourth scenario. Who can afford any of it?
Well, that hasn't stopped our government before, though. They just print more and pretend that we have the money and just go forward.
You know, even a global war, World War I, World War II, most people don't understand that we were responsible for a lot of World War II because of the way we handled the peace at the end, and we sunk the British Navy because we told them to for global peace. But the other side of that is, that's where the power shifted, was World War I. Nobody had money, so we had to finance. So we said, ship us all your gold, we'll give you dollars. That's why we have the world's gold reserves, because we were the world's bank. Who is the world's bank today?
It'll be interesting to see how Trump leads with this, because I think a lot of people, particularly in the presidential race, you know, he was more the libertarian when it came to this, but I don't know. It's gonna be interesting, like when this actually...
Yeah, when push comes to shove.
Exactly.
I think it's kind of what you've been talking about for a long time, is that reset button. And people have always taken that as some extreme thing, and it might be, but we're coming to a point where things are gonna reset.
It will all reset, and the borders will all change. That's what global war does. Mm. And it just makes everybody just hold their breath and say, good Lord, make this stop. And so nobody complains after the war has stopped. Tell me about ISIS.
So ISIS, they are on the verge of losing both their capital cities. Mosul, I got a buddy in Mosul right now that keeps sending me videos. They're just insane. Some insane stories about what life was like under ISIS. He was talking about how the civilians there were forced to live off cat meat. So they were like butchers that had no meat left, and all the meat was, all the food was hoarded by the ISIS soldiers. So all the people banded together, rounded up cats, and they were living off cat meat. Just incredibly sad stories. But they're just about pushed out of Mosul. And American-backed forces are now at the old city, which is pretty far into actual Raqqa in Syria. So they are just on the verge of losing their two major cities. The problem with a lot of this is that, so ISIS is down. They're definitely not out. They're going to get pushed back into areas where they're very, very strong, like the Anbar regions of Iraq. This is where we've already basically done this to them before. We did this to their predecessor when they were called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We destroyed it. We destroyed it with Iraq's help, and they went off into the desert, and they sprung back up and declared their caliphate. We've done this before, so they know what they're doing. They were fully prepared to lose cities when they did this and territory. They're going to go back to the places where they're strong. They're going to wait for sectarian violence to spark back up, provide more soldiers. You're already seeing this with Iranian Shiite militias that are starting to carve up the Middle East. My question is, what is their plan? Because right now, we're not saying we're going to support Assad, but we're actively helping this paramilitary force, which is a terrorist organization, world-designated terrorism organization, to take all this territory. Turkey is already saying that they're going to come in and destroy this group that we're backing once Raqqa falls. So are we going to suddenly just stop supporting these guys and support Turkey, a NATO ally? Or are we going to shift our allegiances over to Assad and Syria? Or are we just going to let Iran take over? They are not saying.
Quagmire is the word you're looking for.
Global quagmire. Global quagmire. Look at who's involved in all of this. Russia is involved in all of this. Iran is involved in all of this. If Iran is involved, North Korea is involved. They're sharing. Russia is involved. If Iran is involved, North Korea involved, China is also involved. I mean, we are looking at a global meltdown.
Well, it's what's happened before, though, is, you know, we'll kind of back one terrorist organization in hopes of defeating another. And then once we defeat the original one, that terrorist organization that we backed becomes the powerful one. And now we got to go find another organization to take them down. So it keeps happening over and over again.
So who's interested to see what's going to happen or has an opinion on what's going to happen with Trump and Putin? It's their first meeting. This is not just an off the cuff. This is a serious negotiation.
Bilateral talk.
Yeah.
So it's not just going to be him and Putin. It's going to be them and their senior advisors
right.
and foreign ministers. And they're set to meet Friday. Is that correct?
Friday. Yeah, Friday.
Well, this will be a chance for Trump to show his modern day presidential, right? So we'll see.
I don't think his modern day tweeting, presidential tweeting, is going to impress Vladimir Putin.
So. I don't expect too much out of the meeting between the two of them. I think that they are pretty much at a couple of, like, there's only so far they're going to go, there's only so far we're going to go, and it doesn't matter how much we think Trump likes Russia or would like to do a reset with Russia. It doesn't matter. That's always campaign talk. The Russian collusion thing, it goes into my, it's dumb. We are never going to be friends with Russia.
Is there a chance that these two men see each other eye to eye because in some ways they're cut from the same cloth?
They have respect for each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's why they're going to have a problem, is because they both want to be, you know, the tough guy. Yeah, they both are going to want to strong arm the other one. And I think that that's why they're going to clash.
But Trump is out of his league if he's trying to clash with Putin.
I don't know who is in their league.
I don't know. Right, exactly. But when has Trump ever admitted that he was out of his league on anything?
Absolutely.
And why would Trump, or why would Putin reinforce that? Why not just play smart and play dead, play friend, and play to his ego?
Well, it also makes him look bad in the media back home if he's like, hey, he's my buddy.
Yeah.
Hey, well, according to CNN, according to the polls, it's still okay. We trust Trump more, or we trust CNN more than we trust Trump, so it's okay. The polls.
That poll is so misleading. Give me the poll numbers.
So online poll, the poll said that people trust
online
CNN.
Poll.
Yes, I know.
Right. Highly scientific, right?
And the New York Times, that they still trust them more than they trust Trump, so it's okay. Right. It's good.
And I know
it's 7
so
points.
Many conservatives that are taking an online poll with the Washington Post and New York Times. So they say conservatives 42 for Trump.
They were saying that Republicans, Trump, they believe in more trustworthy than CNN by 91%. And then Democrats think the opposite. I mean, come on.
So Republicans trust Trump at a 91% rate over CNN?
Yeah, but then the Democrats are on the other side.
So it's just part of
it's just like what it has always been.
Team jerseys.
Right.
It's just team jerseys.
Told us what we already know.
Exactly.